Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Having a thought-provoking, civilized conversation on divergent political issues has never been easy. But today, in this environment, it's nigh well impossible. In fact, at family gatherings, the workplace, or other places where opposing political sympathies meet, there's either a tacit agreement to tiptoe around the subject, or once that door is open, there's an inevitable quick slide into verbal warfare. These days, we save those interesting political discussions for members of our own tribe. But it hasn't always been that way, and it doesn't have to be that way today. My guest, Erica Edelson, is a community activist, a former human rights attorney, and a devotee of powerful non-defensive communication, a way to have dialogue in a way that inspires open-mindedness and consideration of both points of view. Now, Edelson is a devoted progressive, and she admittedly wrote her book to sway minds to her point of view. But the technique she writes about in Beyond Contempt, How Liberals Can Communicate Across the Great Divide, works both ways, at diffusing hostility and building trust with family and friends with differing political views. And it might open our own minds to a new viewpoint as well. And even if we still don't agree, at least we can relearn to listen to each other. A foundation of a civil society. Erica Edelson is my guest on Studio Tulsa. Erica Edelson, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich.
You don't have to look far to see the huge cauldron of contempt that both left and right have for each other these days. And it sounds like many of us, at one point or another, you were a participant in the verbal wars between conservatives and liberals, but something changed. And you wanted to have genuine dialogue with people who don't share your political beliefs. What happened?
You know, what happened for me, I think, is that I kind of overdosed on contempt during and after the 2016 election. You know, of course, at the time, Trump was saying and doing so many things that, for me as a progressive, really triggered my contempt toward him and his supporters. And the thing about contempt is it feels really good in the moment. It's like instant gratification, like a little sugar high, because it activates the reward center of the brain. So I would get this little hit of contempt, and then it wears off, and then I would, you know, want to be back for more. And of course, Trump was always there to supply me with some more material for me to feel contemptuous of. But you know, at some point, I kind of remembered that I was a practitioner of something called powerful non-defensive communication, and that the ways that I was expressing my grief and heartbreak and fear and rage about the things that were going on in this country were very counterproductive from the perspective of the effective communication techniques that I had learned with powerful non-defensive communication. So I started kind of thinking about that more, and then I think there was just sort of this wearing off of the feeling of contempt. I kind of just got tired of it. I felt sort of poisoned by it. I felt like I had a contempt hangover, and I wanted to do something different, especially once I kind of reminded myself of how counterproductive it was in the political arena. It just started to fade away on its own, and that's when I began doing some writing about it, first some articles, and then out of those articles, the idea for the book came about.
As I was reading the book, I was thinking this was this powerful non-defense communication, which we'll hear about in our conversation, was something you came to after experiencing all these things in 2016.
Oh.
But no, it sounds like this predates it, and yet you found yourself succumbing to outrage and contempt.
Sure. Well, that shows just what a powerful force it is. No, I had been studying it for several years, and I had been applying it kind of in my personal life and family life and professional life, which is, you know, generally what PNDC is for. It was not created specifically for use in the political arena. It's more general. And so I had kind of never thought about, oh, could PNDC be used when I want to, you know, do my political activism and express my political beliefs? Just kind of a blind spot. But then it dawned on me, yes, I think it could. And I contacted the creator who taught me all of these techniques. And I asked her, you know, could it be? And she said, yes. And I think that's just what the country needs right now. And she had offered to, you know, be willing to collaborate with me to kind of translate PNDC into the political arena so that I could write this book.
Right now, we're in this hyper-charged environment. I know one of the academics you spoke with is measuring something called outrage discourse. And I don't think you have to look very far. Even if you're not looking for it, it finds you. This idea of outrage that's a part of every part of the political spectrum.
Yeah, it's everywhere. And social media is, of course, the worst. You know, the memes and the Twitter vitriol back and forth. It's absolutely endless. You could really lose yourself there. And then, of course, it's on all the cable news shows on both sides of the aisle. They kind of express it in different ways. They kind of have different styles of showing their outrage, where the left tends to lean a little bit more into mockery and belittling of the other side, and the right tends to lean more into just sort of, you know, steam coming out of their ears, anger and misrepresentations and exaggerations. So they take different styles, but you're right. You see it everywhere. And so it's kind of become quite normalized. And that kind of makes it hard to swim against the current and be the one saying, you know, I think this is harmful. But there certainly are more and more people who are beginning to notice that, maybe this isn't so great for society and democracy.
Well, of course, you know, when you start bringing up things like this, people will automatically accuse you of being a both-sider, you know, that both sides do this. And obviously, the feeling is that one side is doing something worse than the other.
Right.
How do you get beyond that?
One of the principles of powerful non-defensive communication that I think is pretty key is to share your beliefs in a subjective manner, so that rather than saying that, you know, you are the possessor of the absolute truth, to say, you know, this is what I believe and why. And so that does allow for the other person to still have their chance to say what they believe and why. But that doesn't mean that at the end of the conversation you say, oh, you know, I think I see both sides equally now. I mean, if the person does make a valid point, you can, of course, acknowledge that. But I think there's a confusion sometimes where we think that just listening to the other side somehow means that we're validating or agreeing with it, and it doesn't. All it means is that you're setting up the conditions for a dialogue in which you can understand better where they're coming from and speak to it and share your opinion in a way that's more likely to be considered.
Now, your book is titled Beyond Contempt, and contempt is a big part of what you're writing about in the first few chapters. And, you know, there was an NPR story just the other day where a journalist was speaking with Iowa Trump voters. And the feeling of being held in contempt was palpable. In fact, at one point, the journalist said, you feel like you're being thought of as a racist or a misogynist or you know, whatever. And they said, oh, no, we don't feel that it's happening. It is happening. And that seems to be a big story today.
Yeah, I have heard some version of that or read it, you know, 1,000 times in the last few years. It is very much what's happening, that people on the left are making assumptions about what's motivating people who vote for Trump that may or may not be true and may very well be true in a lot of cases. I mean, there's certainly like a huge amount of dog whistling and racist appeal and racist policymaking going on. That's clear. Where it becomes a problem is where you start seeing Trump supporters, you know, all 63 million of them, as this kind of undifferentiated mass of deplorables who are all just like foaming at the mouth with their nativism and their Islamophobia. And so it's like this gigantic, stereotypical Trump supporter, which often comes along with it a lot of classist connotations, you know, that they're rednecks and hillbillies and live in flyover states and are stupid and gullible and ignorant and, you know, and all the rest. It's this whole gigantic sort of wicked knot of stereotypes. And they notice, just like anyone who's a member of a group and doesn't want to be treated like a cardboard cutout, they're the same. They notice. And they don't like it.
We certainly have a number of bad examples throughout the media, CNN, MSNBC. You know, there's eye rolling when somebody makes a point they disagree with. Fox News is the same way. Hosts and commentators belittle, disparage the other side. And certainly within the political sphere itself, you know, the president does mock his political opponents. He mocks people that disagree with his opinions. The Speaker of the House rips up the State of the Union on the House floor right after the speech is ended. There's a lot of bad behavior and bad examples everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, as I say in the book, Trump is absolutely the king of contempt. But I'm not addressing myself in the book to conservatives because I'm not a conservative. Like, they need to clean up their own business. And what I'm concerned with is how the left goes about our expressions of our values and ideas, because I'm on the left, and I want us to be winning, and I want us to be heard and considered. And if someone, you know, rejects our principles and values on the merits, that's fine. Everyone has a right to believe what they want to believe, and I can accept that. But if they're rejecting what we're saying just because we're coming across as self-righteous and condescending and impugning their motives, then that's like an unforced error for my team. And so I'm addressing myself to our bad, not their bad. Certainly, you know, a conservative can pick up the book and learn powerful non-defensive communication principles and practice it on their own. And in fact, I have a conservative friend that I met through my participation in Better Angels who he read the book and he liked it, which was kind of a relief in some ways that I wasn't deepening the divide. But all of the examples in terms of like topical issues and how to talk about different things, they're all geared toward what a liberal or progressive might believe.
My guest today is Erica Edelson. She's a writer, community activist, and certified powerful non-defensive communication facilitator. Her book is titled Beyond Contempt, How Liberals Can Communicate Across the Great Divide. It's published by New Society. Well, beyond the idea of this contempt that conservatives and middle Americans, white Americans, not I'm throwing these out generally, but there's a lot of differences there too, feel about how progressive politics view them, there's a class divide at play, a class of Americans, mostly white, but not exclusively, who feel leaders of both parties have been pretty alienated from their concerns for about a generation or so. And they found in this president someone who will speak to those concerns. Now, we can debate how much has been done by that president actually to help them. But there's also another party that you write about, by their own admission, has branded their party as a party of cosmopolitan elites and a diverse America. I'm going to ask you, in your view, what's the danger in branding your politics to a culture and identity or class as opposed to the whole?
Well, I think that one of the things that the right has done, kind of going all the way back to Nixon and his Southern strategy, is to divide the working class by stoking racial fears.
Racial resentment, oftentimes.
Yeah. So, I mean, if the working class, if white working class Americans were to come to see that they have more in common and that their bread is buttered in the same way as working class people of color, and that the real problem is powerful elites who have too much money and power and are exploiting workers and offshoring jobs and, you know, all the other problems that we have, then the working class and, you know, kind of lower middle class people could be coming together and uniting behind an agenda that's for all working and middle-class people. But instead, what's happening is, you know, the people like Trump are so successful at doing this divide and conquer. And part of why he's good at it is that he's able to kind of point at the so-called liberal elite, right? And this is a trope that goes all the way back to the 60s when John Lindsay, the liberal mayor of New York, was running for re-election and his challenger called him a limousine liberal, right? So we had limousine liberals and then latte liberals, and now it's the liberal elite. And Trump is able to point at the liberal elite, he and, you know, people in right-wing media, the Rush Limbaughs and the Sean Hannity and so forth, and say, you know, listen to them. They're calling you racist rednecks. They hate you. They do nothing for you. They don't care about you. So come to us, because we'll honor you as the real Americans. We'll pay lip service. That's not what he said, but that's my interpretation, you know, that they'll at least sort of pretend to care about them and their well-being. And so, I mean, in my opinion, neither party is really doing much of anything that's going to be substantively improving the lives of working people whose fortunes are waning, working people of all colors and races in this country. But at least if one side is kind of stoking their wounded pride or promising to restore their honor in some vague way, well, that's something. And I don't see the Democrats, well, now some of the candidates are, but I think that that has been the problem with some of the Democratic candidates of the past, and particularly with Hillary Clinton. And I'll just tell a story here because that I think is so illuminating, because I'm sure, you know, most of your listeners remember when Hillary Clinton said that half of Trump supporters belong in a basket of deplorables. And this was like a couple months before the election, September of 2016. And it took the Trump campaign all of 48 hours to create an attack ad based on that comment. And at the end of the ad, the voiceover says, "You know what's deplorable? Hillary Clinton viciously demonizing hardworking people like you." And that ad aired 765 times in battleground states. I mean, it was like political gold for Trump. And then much later, and I only came across this recently, this article from 2017 by a Clinton campaign consultant named Diane Hessen. And she said that at the time that Hillary made that deplorables gaffe, she, Diane Hessen, the consultant, was in swing states interviewing undecided voters. And her observation was that the deplorables comment was the turning point. That was when Hillary Clinton lost the election, because the swing voters were so insulted and outraged. It was like all they could talk about. And they openly told her that they decided to vote for Trump because he didn't think they were deplorable.
Now, of course, as you know, the full quote goes on to mention that she talks about that middle America that hasn't been spoken to. But the damage was done, is what you're saying.
The damage was done, and it was inevitable that, you know, Fox News and others were only going to play the first half of that. I mean, I am sympathetic to her that second half got cut off, but that was inevitable. And also, you know, she said even in the half that did play, it wasn't like she said like a few or some. She said half. So she's talking about like 32 million people. That's a pretty big generalization.
So what are the first steps in communicating across political divides? Let's go ahead and talk about the use of powerful non-defensive communication. What are the first steps?
So powerful non-defensive communication is a non-adversarial communication method. And the kind of general idea is to communicate or resolve conflicts in ways that avoid triggering defensiveness. The basic idea is that you find out by asking questions where the other person is coming from, and then you share where you're coming from, but without trying to convince them, and without implying that they're bad or inferior to you if they don't agree, getting back to the deplorables thing again. You refrain from kind of the judgment and shaming. So it begins with curiosity questions, where you're just trying to understand why the person believes what they believe. You're gathering information so that you feel some degree of confidence that you understand their reasoning or their experiences that have led them to believe what they believe, so that you're not making assumptions. Because I think one of the things that happens so often is we can be pretty quick to either not ask the other person any questions, or just ask a couple of questions and only sort of half listen while we're trying to figure out what we're going to say to rebut them. And then we jump in with our position, which might be pretty loaded with accusations and assumptions about what we think is motivating the other person. So it's just good to check in, to kind of draw out their story, their experiences, their facts, their reasoning, and then you can share yours.
You write that shame is a big weapon in our political arguments. And any time when we have conflict, that shame will be a big weapon. And how is it used in political discourse?
Well, it's this idea that you can, like, shame the badness out of someone. You can shame them out of being a racist. shame them out of being a sexist, that, you know, you just kind of, I mean, it's sort of the deplorables thing again. Like, if you just tell someone how deplorable they are, that they'll be like, oh, yeah, you're right. Thanks for pointing that out. I am deplorable, and I hereby renounce my pre-existing beliefs, and thank you, dear liberal. Now, you know, tell me what I should believe instead. That's not going to happen.
I think you're right. Dave Fleischer of the Leadership Lab said, tell me the time someone shamed you out of anything and that you were grateful for it.
Exactly. And, oh, gosh, I would really recommend your listeners listen to his TED Talk. It is so incredible. He has so many insights, and he has such an incredible story of how his canvassers, he trained canvassers in Miami. So this was a few years ago when Miami had just passed a transgender bathroom bill that protected transgender people from discrimination in their in terms of what public bathroom they could use. And the bill passed, but it was like still really divisive, and there was a lot of hostility around it. So Dave Fleischer with the Los Angeles LGBT Leadership Lab trained canvassers to go door to door and talk to people about their feelings about this new law, and in the hopes that, you know, by talking it through, more people would become comfortable with it, because it was, you know, really a new concept to most people in Miami. And in the midst of his TED Talk, which I hope people watch, he shows a clip of a transgender canvasser named Virginia who knocks on the door, and this elderly man named Gustavo answers the door. And she starts out by asking him, you know, what he thinks about the transgender bathroom ordinance. And he says, I don't think I like that. And she says, okay, well, why not? And he says, well, you know, in South America, where I'm from, you know, we don't like f***s. Ooh, and it's like, oh, my God. And, you know, you can imagine yourself in that situation, even if you're not gay or transgender, just, like, going on red alert. Like, oh, my God, he said f***, this horrible homophobe. You know, what should I do? Can I shame the homophobia out of him right now? How do I do that? But what Virginia was trained to do was, you know, not to get triggered by that, and to continue asking questions and ultimately sharing her story, or I'm sorry, their story. Virginia goes by the pronoun they. And Virginia starts asking about Gustavo's wife, and Gustavo talks about how his wife is ailing and he takes care of her because he loves her so much. And then Virginia says, oh, you know, I love my partner so much. And they are pulling out their smartphones and showing pictures of each other's partners, and it's kind of all, you know, warm and cuddly. And then Gustavo says, so tell me why you're gay. Why did you choose to be gay? And again, you know, this could be like a real kind of triggering question, like, what do you mean? No one chooses to be gay, you fool. But Virginia says, oh, you know, it's not a choice. I am who I am, and I just love who I love, and that's the way it is, and I'm so excited to spend the rest of my life with my partner and take care of her just like you are. And they go on, and then at the end of this exchange, really without any prompting from Virginia, Gustavo says, you know, no one has ever taken the time to explain things like this to me before, and you know what? I think I was mistaken. And, you know, I'm watching this, and I'm just thinking, this is like a miracle. This is how you do it. And this isn't just a one-off, because this Dave Fleischer's canvassing operation, you know, went all over Miami and had an academic researcher tracking the campaign and found that these conversations made a deep and lasting impression on people and really dialed down their transphobia and their acceptance of this anti-discrimination ordinance.
How has it worked in your conversations across the political divide?
It's, I guess it depends on what you mean by worked. I don't have like a ton of stories of some kind of like magical thing like the Virginia Gustavo story that I just told. The way I look at it is, if I can plant a seed and at the end of the conversation, the person's just sort of, you know, respectfully like, huh, yeah, you know, I can kind of see what you're saying, or you've given me something to think about, or let's talk about it some more, or do you have any reading materials for me? Basically, I would take any of those scenarios as a success, because I do believe, because I know I'm this way, I'm very unlikely to like shift in the moment. You know, maybe I have too much ego and too much adversarial lawyer training in me. But I really prefer to think about something in my own time. And there are things that, you know, people say, and I toss it around for a long time before I make a shift. But if the person has planted a seed and done it in a way that didn't trigger my defensiveness, then, you know, then I can work it over in my mind. And so that's what I see as a success. I mean, I do have one story I can share if we still have time, that's sort of more of the classic, like, oh, I think that quote unquote worked. I was in Kentucky a few months ago canvassing for in the gubernatorial election there, and that was where the incumbent Republican Matt Bevin was being challenged by a Democrat named Andy Beshear. Basically, that whole campaign was about health care because Bevin, the Republican, was trying to dismantle the health care exchanges. He was trying to exclude pre-existing conditions from mandatory coverage. And, I mean, that was, like, really, really the key issue for Kentucky. A lot of Kentuckians were facing losing their health care, and that was what was giving this Democrat in a red state like Kentucky, even giving him even a chance of winning. So I go knock on the door, and this woman answers, and I ask my standard first question, which is, oh, you know, when you go to the polls next week, what issue's going to be top of mind for you? And she starts off by saying, oh, well, you know, I could never vote for a baby killer like Beshear. Mm. Oh, my gosh. So I had to channel the Virginia Gustavo dialogue that I described earlier. I'm saying, hey, be like Virginia. So I'm trying not to freak out or run away because I come from Berkeley, California, and I don't hear that sentiment very often. So, you know, it was shocking. And then she kept talking, and then she said that she had had cancer and that it was in remission, and she said, you know, if pre-existing conditions are excluded and my cancer comes back, I'm screwed. And then she says, so I have to vote for Bevin, the Republican, because Beshear said he's going to get rid of pre-existing condition coverage. And so I'm thinking, what the heck? And this woman has the whole thing completely backwards. But I couldn't say that. Right. I mean, I couldn't be like, lady, what planet are you on? You've got it completely backwards, because that would have totally put her on the defensive and she wouldn't have wanted to listen to me. So I said, this is where the subjectivity is important. I said, it sounds to me like making sure that you have health coverage is like an absolute life or death issue for you. And it's the most important issue for me, too. That's why I'm out here campaigning, because I don't want to see anyone in this state losing their health care. And I think where you and I have a difference is that we have different information, because from everything I've read, it's Bevin who's trying to get rid of pre-existing conditions, and it's Beshear who said that he is going to put a stop to that on day one and make sure that pre-existing conditions are covered. And there was this look of shock and confusion on her face. It was, I will never forget it. It wasn't defensive. It wasn't like, oh, you know, that's just fake news. What are you talking about? That was the first she had heard of it, and I think she realized that she was wrong and that she was about to potentially have cast her vote in a way that could have cost her her life. So anyway, so I didn't push the point. At that point, I just said, okay, so, you know, here's some campaign literature. You can check it out for yourself. And then I walked away. So, of course, I don't know how that woman ended up voting. I suspect that she ended up voting for the Democrat. And that's so important because, like, in that election, Beshear, the Democrat, only won by 5,000 votes. And a lot of those votes were people who had voted for Trump and had voted for Bevin and were now flipping.
Erica Edelson is a writer, community activist, and certified powerful non-defensive communications facilitator. Her book is titled Beyond Contempt: How Liberals Can Communicate Across the Great Divide. It's published by New Society. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.